The OI Guy, Peter Rowe, MD, on living well with orthostatic intolerance in ME/CFS, POTS, and long COVID, a book review and talk by Court Johnson, October 5th, 2024. This blog contains a review of Dr. Peter Rowe's book, Living Well with Orthostatic Intolerance, a guide to diagnosis and treatment, and a talk with Dr. Rowe. Dr. Rowe is the first person to publish a book on diagnosing and treating orthostatic intolerance, or OI, the inability to stand or sometimes even be upright without symptoms. That's no surprise. Dr. Rowe broke the news on OI and ME/CFS decades ago and has been piling up firsts ever since. It's hard to imagine what the chronic fatigue syndrome ME/CFS field would be like without him. He was the first to find neurally mediated hypotension in ME/CFS in 1995, the first to find neurally mediated hypotension in fibromyalgia in 1997, the first to produce an OI clinical trial in ME/CFS in 2001, the first to find neuromuscular strain in ME/CFS in 2013. The first to document the effects of dairy in ME/CFS patients with intolerance to cow milk protein in 2016. The first to show that short-duration tilt table tests missed many people with POTS and should be abandoned in 2018. The first to show that health-related quality of life was substantially worse in children with ME/CFS than in a variety of serious diseases in 2019. Dr. Rowe was the first to show that virtually everyone with ME/CFS, whether or not they met the criteria for orthostatic intolerance, has reduced blood flows to the brain, and that was in 2020. He was the first to show that even sitting up dramatically reduces blood flows to the brain in people with more severe ME/CFS in 2020. He was the first to show that deconditioning does not cause orthostatic intolerance in ME/CFS in 2021. The first to show that brain blood flows are reduced in long COVID in 2021. The first to show that cervical stenosis can mimic the symptoms of ME/CFS in 2013. That chronotropic incompetence was occurring during tilt table tests in ME/CFS in 2023, and the first to show that even elite swimmers can suffer from orthostatic intolerance and benefit from treatments to address it in 2023. And lastly, he was the first to connect dysautonomia to post-treatment Lyme disease in 2024. Living Well with Orthostatic Intolerance, A Guide to Diagnosis and Treatment, is a book that deserves to be on every chronic fatigue syndrome, POTS, long COVID, joint hypermobility, post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome, post-cancer fatigue, and even every fibromyalgia patient's shelf. Orthostatic intolerance has shown up repeatedly in fibromyalgia when fibromyalgia researchers have chosen to look at it. Check out some reviews. Quote, Living Well with Orthostatic Intolerance is a brilliant and timely book that will help patients around the world. Written by an international expert with decades of experience, Dr. Rowe provides the basics, the latest treatment approaches, and invaluable clinical pearls and patient vignettes. This book brings light into the darkness of this much misunderstood disorder. End quote. Brian A. Fallon, Columbia University Irving Medical Center. Or how about this one? Quote, Dr. Peter Rowe has compiled his decades of clinical experience in caring for people with chronic fatigue and POTS into a highly readable and informative volume. This book is essential reading for those living with orthostatic intolerance and for those who care for them. The tools for a deep understanding of this challenging clinical problem are all here. End quote. Claire A. Francomano, Indiana University School of Medicine, co-editor, Symptomatic, the Symptom-Based Handbook for Ehlers-Danlos Syndrome and Hypermobility Spectrum Disorders. Rowe has produced superb treatment summaries for orthostatic intolerance in the past, but this is not them. This is a full-fledged examination of orthostatic intolerance, complete with all sorts of interesting asides and tweaks and case reports that you won't get anywhere else. The book grew out of a workbook that Rowe had been adding onto for decades. All proceeds from the book will go to supporting his clinic. It's not a dense tome. It was primarily written for patients and their families. But I think the place I would want to see it most would be sitting on a doctor's shelf, or in his, her Kindle. Besides abundant information on Dr. Rowe's medication dosing, the book shows how he works with a patient, tweaking this and that medication until the patient either hopefully gets significantly better or even recovers. While dramatic recovery stories are scattered throughout the book, this isn't a do this and cure OI book. While Rowe is often able to help, he is clear that he hits a wall with some patients. These are not diseases that succumb to a kind of cookie-cutter approach. Each patient is an individual, and it can take time and patience to track down the combination of treatments that work best for her or him. In our talk, Rowe said, quote, "There's a tremendous amount of inter-individual variability in the responses to medications and the number of things that people are dealing with. So it's really a puzzle to be sorted out for each person, and there's no one-size-fits-all," end quote. This, of course, is why specialists like Rowe are so valuable. One of the book's great contributions is to empower physicians and patients not to give up too early in their journey and to recognize that they could be a step or two from a life-changing treatment. Similarly, the book empowers patients to look for the kind of healthcare provider who is willing to experiment. If they can find that practitioner, they have a real shot at better health. Note, Health Rising's doctor review project will be up soon. It all starts with diagnosis, and with many doctors ignorant about dysautonomia or orthostatic intolerance, getting properly diagnosed can take some work. It took years before Lauren Stiles rather dramatically self-diagnosed her own case of POTS while in the hospital. Similarly, in his recent book, Matthew Robinson reports that he saw dozens of doctors before he was diagnosed with POTS at the Bateman Horne Center. The diagnosis section outlines a standing test that patients can take at home and bring the results to their doctor. If the test is positive, patients can take the results, plus perhaps the paper that validates the test and or blogs from Health Rising to help educate their doctors. Doctors can follow up with tilt table tests if they wish, but the Doppler ultrasound test presents an intriguing possibility for enterprising doctors as the equipment is widely used and only requires the proper software to get done. Dysautonomia International has been providing the equipment to some doctors. The dramatic drops in blood flows to the brain typically seen will surely spark the interest in even a skeptical doctor. Rowe describes the symptoms associated with these types and subtypes, the large array of non-pharmacological approaches, from cooler baths and showers to small, low-carb meals, to using shoes with a higher heel, to elevating the head of the bed, compression and cooling garments, increasing salt intake, and other things that can help. One of Rowe's more intriguing discoveries concerns the movement restrictions, increased mechanical tension, and postural asymmetries he finds in many of his patients that can set off the symptoms of orthostatic intolerance. Relieving these via gentle manual physical therapy techniques such as neural mobilization, myofascial release, strain counter-strain maneuvers, and craniosacral therapy often helps patients tolerate aerobic activity better. Rowe describes the many conditions, some of them quite obscure, that can be associated with orthostatic intolerance, including median arcuate ligament syndrome, thoracic outlet syndrome, cervical spinal stenosis, Chiari type 1, craniocervical instability, pelvic vein incompetence, endometriosis, irritable bowel syndrome, mast cell activation syndrome, and others. He provides treatment algorithms he's developed over decades of practice, i.e., high systolic blood pressure calls for these drugs, high heart rate at baseline suggests the doctor try these drugs first, etc. Rowe raised many eyebrows when he noted that stimulants don't just stimulate the nervous system, but also can help the blood vessels in the legs vasoconstrict or narrow, thus driving more blood to the brain. He raised my eyebrows even more when he reported that antidepressants, SSRIs, Prozac, Zoloft, Lexapro, SNRIs, such as Effexor, Cymbalta, can increase circulatory functioning in people with orthostatic intolerance. Who knew? Birth control pills are another potential mediator of orthostatic intolerance symptoms that I had not heard of. Deep dives into how to use common medications such as Florinef, Atenolol, stimulants, Mitodrine, SSRIs, Mestinon, Desmopressin, Clonidine, Guanfacine, and Ivabradine give an interested doctor a good head start on how to pharmacologically treat orthostatic intolerance. Case histories. My favorite section of the book, though, contains 10 case histories demonstrating the wide range of orthostatic problems that can be present, and the even wider range of treatment options available. Here are some of them. The former dancer. There was the former dancer, possible hypermobility clue, with purple hands and feet, occasional periods when her vision goes black, and who experienced lightheadedness and headaches and had trouble standing long enough to do her physical rotations. Upon examination, she had a high Batten score, hypermobility, and a 10-minute standing test suggested she had POTS. An increase in breathing rate at the end of the standing test suggested that she was losing carbon dioxide, causing the blood vessels in her brain to vasoconstrict, resulting in cognitive problems. Over a period of 6 months or so, Rowe and the patients settled in on a course of Atenolol, oral contraceptive pills, and Mitodrine to counteract connective tissue laxity in her blood vessel walls. 10 years later, she had dropped the stimulant and was only taking Atenolol, and her POTS symptoms were greatly reduced. The teenager with purple feet. A 16-year-old female was healthy and active until she began experiencing fatigue, unrefreshing sleep, dizziness, headaches, post-exertional malaise, difficulty concentrating, and was unable to attend school. On exam, she displayed acrocyanosis, or purplish feet, a high Batten score for hypermobility, high heart rate, and low blood pressure during a tilt table test. She was diagnosed with POTS and neurally mediated hypotension. Fludrocortisone, or Florinef, and increased salt and fluid intake allowed her to resume school, begin working at two jobs, and exercise again. 10 years later, she was doing fine, except for periods when she had to temporarily discontinue Florinef. The spinal patient. She had been well until the age of 12 when she was hit with a gastrointestinal infection that destabilized more than her gut. By the time she was 15, her fatigue, lightheadedness, and brain fog left her unable to attend school. While her tilt table test indicated she had POTS, medications failed to help. An alert physical therapist found increased tension in neck muscles, dug further, and found that she exhibited a positive Hoffman sign, which is often found in those with abnormalities in their cervical spine. Interestingly, her mother had quite a history of neck problems, cervical spinal stenosis, narrowing of the spinal canal through which the cerebral spinal fluid flows, 2 spinal fusions, and 2 operations for thoracic outlet syndrome. An MRI showed an abnormal clivoaxial angle, CXA, a narrowed cervical spinal canal, spinal stenosis, and a congenital disc bulge at C6, C7. The clivoaxial angle is the angle between the base of the skull and the axis of the spine. Her reduced CXA suggested that her skull was compressing the brainstem, i.e., that she had craniocervical instability. 2 months after undergoing the least invasive surgery possible, disc replacement at the C6, C7 bulge, she was able to work as a dog walker and vet tech, and experienced significant reductions in her anxiety and lightheadedness. 6 months later, she was working at a dude ranch for the summer, and a year later, she was a full-time college student holding down a part-time job. A standing test indicated her POTS had resolved. Finding the one thing. A cytomegalovirus kicked things off in this 14-year-old. She managed to make it through both high school and college, but was unable to do much more than concentrate on her studies. Vigorous exercise kicked off her migraines. Unlike the other patients, her orthostatic intolerance had been well diagnosed, and she'd tried many treatments for it and her fatigue. Beta blockers, fludrocortisone, propranolol, stimulants, mestinon, clonidine, oral contraceptives, and many others were trialed to no avail. Noticing that she had a high resting heart rate of more than 100 beats per minute, Dr. Rowe tried her on ivabradine. It turned out that she had just missed the one drug that could help her. Ivabradine controlled her heart rate, allowing her to exercise. If she temporarily goes off the drug, her heart rate, lightheadedness, and cognitive exercise problems return. A complex patient. A 16-year-old male with a history of infectious episodes, as well as colic as a child, had been experiencing fatigue, lightheadedness, migraines, headaches upon standing, heartburn, abdominal pain, frequent awakening during sleep, mild depression, and mouth ulcers. His orthostatic intolerance had been diagnosed, but fludrocortisone didn't help. His high Batten score, 7 out of 9, flat feet and other symptoms, indicated he was hypermobile. His history of gastrointestinal symptoms and tenderness in the epigastric area, below the ribs in the upper abdomen, suggested he was reacting to something in his diet. Rowe diagnosed him with milk intolerance and turned to a compounded form of fludrocortisone that was free of dairy. Rowe pointed out that milk protein intolerance usually produces upper gastrointestinal symptoms, while lactose intolerance produces abdominal bloating, cramping, and diarrhea. He has found that if you are intolerant of dairy products and are taking them, no treatments will help until the dairy is removed. With his gut symptoms resolved, Rowe prescribed escitalopram, which improved his mood. To combat the migraines, lightheadedness that occurred upstanding, and muscle tightness, Rowe added in 5 to 10 milligrams mitodrine every 4 hours, 3 times daily, and he began working with a physical therapist. That resolved his migraines and allowed him to gradually expand his activity level. A year later, he was able to more fully participate in soccer without crashes and join his tennis team. Mestinon scores in complex patient. An 18-year-old cross-country runner experiences unusual fatigue. Strep throat and a gut infection result in lightheadedness, fatigue, and, particularly, gut pain and vomiting. Tilt table testing indicates POTS. Mitodrine, 5 milligrams every 4 hours, 3 times a day, fludrocortisone, 0.15 milligrams once a day, amitriptyline, 20 milligrams once a day, and compression stockings help with her gut pain and lightheadedness, and she's able to start college. Another gut infection strikes, though, and her fatigue, etc. worsens. She's having lots of gut pain and nausea most of the day. She's feeling depressed, and her wellness score sinks to 35 out of 100. Dr. Rowe finds she has elevated left shoulder and rightward tilt of the neck, and physical therapy is begun. After removing dairy from her diet, her gut symptoms and nausea disappear. A rejigger of her mitodrine, 10 milligrams every 4 hours, and escitalopram, 10 milligrams per day, ups her wellness score to 60 out of 100. After laboratory testing suggested low iron, supplemental iron improved her energy and allowed faster recovery from exercise. After 6 weeks of part-time college classes, though, she had to withdraw because of excessive fatigue. Adding in pyridostigmine bromide, or mestinon, 180 milligrams daily over time, did the trick. Within a month, she was doing 45 minutes of kayaking. By her 7th month follow-up, her wellness score was 75 out of 100. At 8 months, it was up to 85 out of 100, and she'd successfully returned to college. At 18 months, her score was up to 90 out of 100. She made the Dean's List at college and completed 25-kilometer races. She eventually completed a PhD in physical therapy and was able to wean off all her orthostatic intolerance meds. A talk with Dr. Peter Rowe. I talked with Dr. Rowe about his new book, How He Treats Orthostatic Intolerance, and what he's excited about right now in the field. And you can see a link to that talk in the text version of the article. An addendum to the talk. Traditional 10-minute tilt table tests may catch most people with POTS, but will miss a lot of people who actually deserve to be treated, according to Dr. Rowe. They will miss people who would have experienced blood pressure drops if the test had been extended, as well as people who develop symptoms while being tilted upright after a time, presumably because of reduced blood flows to the brain. But they don't meet the criteria for orthostatic intolerance. The key with tilt table tests is to focus on symptoms. Lax veins. Dr. Rowe recently showed that using stents to improve blood flows in the pelvis improved many of the ME/CFS-like symptoms in women with chronic pelvic pain, interstitial cystitis. Overly lax veins, probably caused by connective tissue damage, appear to be allowing blood to pool in the pelvis, producing symptoms of orthostatic intolerance, pain during intercourse, and other symptoms in this group. Blood pooling problems with blood flows appear to be a common theme in many disorders associated with ME/CFS and could be occurring in varicose veins, the pelvic region, interstitial cystitis, the abdomen, legs, POTS, irritable bowel syndrome, IBS, fibromyalgia, and of course, ME/CFS, reduced venous blood flows in the legs, reduced preload, reduced blood flows to the brain. The idea is that interrupting the free flow of blood anywhere in the body can impair blood flows to the brain as well. Klaus Wirth and Matthew Lone have proposed that reduced blood flows may be at work in endometriosis and dysmenorrhea, painful periods, and may be affecting the vasa vasorum, or small blood vessels that feed the large blood vessels. They've proposed that both precapillary cardiovascular problems, low blood volume, low cardiac filling, vasoconstriction issues, and capillary disturbances, microclots, large monocytes, damaged red blood cells, sticky red blood cells, may be causing blood flow problems in ME/CFS and similar diseases. Finally, a real team. Rose Johns Hopkins Pediatric Clinic was held together by paper and string for decades. At first, he worked by himself. Next, he got a research volunteer, then a nurse. Lately, he's been able to hire two more people, including a doctor focused on ME/CFS and long COVID. Finally, he said, he has a real team. The clinic has been helped greatly by philanthropic donations. Please support Health Rising and keep the information flowing. You can give a one-time donation at the link in the text version of the article.